the presence of our Tanzania sisters and brother. I think I've got the plurals right on that, don't I? Their presence is one more, it seems to me, proof of my constant contention as a city person that this is not a village, that this is a city. You don't get this kind of an interchange in a village. You don't get African missionaries crossing with the kind of other diverse resources that Holden has to offer very often in the normal village. So this is a city. Welcome again to the Holden Urban Forum. What we really want to do tonight is to continue what we've actually been doing, I think, most of us, for the last days with our friends who have been in Tanzania, and that is to simply ask them questions and enter into conversation with them. We do, as Dan Olson pointed out, have 400 years of experience here. We're not going to plumb all of those 400 years in the first hour here. I hope that some of you have had some chance to chat with these remarkable people during the week. But we do want to give one last concentrated shot at them before they all hop on the boat tomorrow. So we are just delighted to have all of you reuniting in Holden Village. And I think it's particularly appropriate that you're here during the weeks that Dan Olson is here and Barbara and are sharing their experience and perspective on a variety of African questions. So this is a kind of Africa evening set in the middle of of some Africa weeks for us. I guess I will turn the forum over for a couple of initial remarks to Marian Halverson, who claims not to have a title, but who clearly is some kind of an organizer.
She's a literacy consultant.
It helps us all in that area, no doubt. All right. Marian is going to fill us in a little bit more on the kinds of resources we've got here with these 400 years. And then we'll just open it up for some questions and back and forth. Marian?
First of all, Greta over here is our statistician, and she worked out the statistics of when we all came, when we all came, So if somebody wanted to study this a little more later, you know something more about these 400 years. And I noticed Jody said something about the first hour, and I suppose all of you knowing missionaries and longevity, that you're planning on staying, you know, until around midnight, so we have a chance to tell our stories in detail.
We'll formally knock it off at 10, but anybody who wants to keep on in porch conversation can do that. The years here are 1937, by the way, to 1982. So that's the kind of
all of us have to be retired. And if you look at that, you'll notice that the bulk of the work was between, say, about 1952 on to about the late 60s, early 70s, when there were a good many missionaries in Tanzania. Now I think there are five or six missionary couples and two single workers left in Tanzania, which is as it should be, because the church and the leadership of the church is over to nationals. And those of you who have had the privilege, as we have this week, you know, God really plans his program. He brought the Reverend Olson here from our LCA office, the secretary of the Africa secretary for LCA. And we didn't know he was going to be here, and I don't think he knew any of us were coming. But that's how the Lord arranges things. He's been tremendously helpful for me, and I know for all the rest of us here, to have the overview that he gives us. You know, we as missionaries get bogged down in one little place and one little thing that we're doing, and we can't hardly see what is over and beyond. But he's made the statement many times this week that Africa is predicted to become the most Christian continent on the globe within the next 15 years, by the year 2000. And I thought I would just expand on that a little bit, and then perhaps we could think about why this has happened. He's given us some very good ideas on why it's happened. at the turn of the century, there were only 4 million Christians on the continent of Africa. Now, statistics are all the time to come by. In 1900, 4 million. And the population was estimated, let's say, at 125 million. In 1980, according to David Barrett's statistics, and he had his office right above mine when I lived in Nairobi, so I got some of the information rather firsthand, approximately 200 million Christians with a population out of a population of 450 million. It's predicted that by 2000, if the church continues to grow as it is today, that there will be 450 million. And the population, 750 million. So you see from the population growth that even if the families that are already Christian continue to produce children as they have been, that this accounts for a large degree of the growth. But we say, why has this happened? I know when I first went to Tanzania, I learned very soon that one of the reasons for the growth of the church was the the fact that the Holy Spirit had prepared the people through the indigenous African priests of their traditional religion. And when we came to the Ilamba tribe, we heard that the Ilamba tribal priests of their traditional religion had prophesied that there would be coming some pink-skinned people and that they would be coming with a message and the book of God. And the people were told, when they come, listen to them, receive them, and receive their words, because they are coming with the words of the true Creator, whom they all knew as Creator, but because of the sinfulness of man, he had departed and left them on their own. And now they were to hear the truth. I told this story when I was down in South Africa, in Swaziland, in a literacy workshop. And one of the ladies in the workshop said, oh, we had that story. We were told that light-skinned people would be coming with hair like corn tassels. They were coming with two things. They were coming with a message and with money. Receive the message, reject the money. But she said, our problems stem from the fact that we receive both. And if any of you have read Eternity in Their Hearts by Don Richardson, we learned that this same thing was true in Ethiopia among the Gedi people, among the people of Chad and the Central African Republic. And I think it would be very interesting for somebody to do research and find out how many of the tribes of Africa actually had this prediction made by their traditional priests. Now, the only thing I'm going to do now is introduce the people that are here, and then we're going to ask you for your questions and anything you would like to ask us. We have a group of nurses here. I think we've asked you to stay. All of you who have been nurses. Alice Turnblad, Margaret Peterson, Edith Shalene, Greta Engberg, and Elna Mae Lindahl, better known as Lindy. We have Dr. Spann, whom you saw this evening when he read the scriptures, and one of the teachers, single workers in Africa, and educationist. Now we'll have the teachers stand. Mary Eddy, Inez Olson, Mildred Bolston, and Joyce Lund, Eileen Nelson, Jacobson. Where's her husband over here?
I'm here.
He hasn't had a chance to be in Africa, so he's sort of sitting in the background. And Juliet Anderson Morris. Marion Johnson and Del Brown.
And Margaret.
Oh, I'm sorry, Margaret Watson. You were hiding back there. Margaret was in Tanzania and in Kenya. She went home for a while and came back again and served until very recently, year before last. Then we have Ina Abrahamson, who was a librarian and a good many other things.
I just volunteered for 1 year, so I'm just
heard of all those things.
You were.
Is there anybody else I've missed? Now it's over to you.
Let's just take questions, particularly there, you know, a lot of developments in medicine and teaching, and in the literacy projects, I think that would be interesting to know about. But let's just open it up. Yes, sir.
I don't know whether this is a question or just a request. I would appreciate a little bit more background about Tanzania. I'm really focused about its origin. I know it used to be called Tanganyika, and it used to be a German colony, but maybe a little bit more fill in on the political structure and that sort of thing.
Somebody else want to do that?
120 different tribes. It was German East Africa before the First World War. It had, when I went out there, 8 million people. How many are there out there now? 4 million?
18 and a half million.
I went out in the 1940s. And it had as many different languages, 120 different languages. Now they're trying to, and the lingua franco is Kiswahili. Now somebody else add on what I had forgotten.
Why it's called Tanzania instead of Tanganyika.
Oh yeah, well somebody else tell them why it's called Tanzania.
That's because of Zanzibar coming into the republic. They joined hands and became a republic in 1964. And I think they wanted to comfort Zanzibar by having the Zan in there instead of the Gan. So it's Tanzania instead of Tanganyika. So it's in the island of Pemba too, isn't it? Pemba, Zanzibar, and Tanganyika became a republic in 1964.
But independence was 1961. It had been a trust territory under the United Nations to Britain prior to that time. And the church work actually started in the late 1880s when some of the first German missionaries were there. Our church work began during the First World War when the Americans came in. When some teachers were, after the German missionaries had been in interim, some of the teachers walked about 300 miles to the station where they had heard some American missionaries had arrived and said, "We want American missionaries to come down to the central region of Tanzania," because they heard that there were a few up in the northern region of Tanzania. And it was at that time then that our board, the Augustana Lutheran Board, sent some of the first missionaries.
You can get Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska in Tanzania. There are three states. I come from Kansas.
many of you were present then in the early 60s when independence came and when the British Trust Territory status was shifted. Could you talk about what difference that made, what you saw happening as independence came, and what difference that made for your work, if any?
Let me share one thing about the literacy work. Since they appointed me, I felt it. When I went to Tanzania in 1946, the among the men, the literacy rate was between 60-65%. It was over 95% of the women were still illiterate. When we tried to involve the British government officers in the adult educational program, which the church felt was an essential, they said, "You're wasting your time. They don't need to learn to read. They don't want to learn to read. Forget it." And then because we were quite insistent, they said, "Well, since you are so insistent, we'll give you the green light, but don't expect any help from us." But all of that changed with independence, when it became then a national priority for everybody in the country to learn to read. I was back 2 years ago. I talked at that time to one of the men who had been on one of our literacy teams for writing materials. And he is now vice chancellor of the university. And he reported that illiteracy has been reduced to less than 10%, and that they expected by this year it to be down to 5% of the total population. So that's quite a shift.
From an overall rate of
70%. Overall rate of at least 80% in 1946.
Was there any similar development in the health area, those of you who worked in health?
Well, we could start from the very beginning. I think Dr. Boris here was out there before I was, but there wasn't much. There was a hospital built, and there were no nurses who were, there were no nurses beside just us. And then there were one doctor and three nurses to 300,000 people. Right, Edie?
Two doctors first, then one went home.
Yeah.
And then another one came, and then we welcomed Dr. Lewis.
Yeah.
I had been about a little over a year before that.
And then the exciting thing, I think, is, and Edie was there, and I can remember going to the hospital, and what we had then were called dressers. Dressers because they had many sores caused by malnutrition and... Yaws, we saw yaws disappear. But anyhow, they were called dressers because they had to wrap the wounds, or the sores, or whatever you want to call them. Then they would say, oh, mama. It's called mama in those days. give us classes. Well, we tried a few little classes for them. Then started dressers training. And, come on, Stan, butt in. And then they started what we call the rural medical assistants, a little higher education, those who had 6 years of previous education. All boys, no girls, because girls were not educated. Girls could not read and write, and they were not to have this kind of a job. All they did was to bear children and to take care of the cows and chickens. And the next procedure was what we call medical assistants, which was a little higher education so that they could assist the doctors out there. In that time, there was a continual push to get nurses a nursing education into the area. Well, the first class had three girls and five boys, and they were the first nursing students and the first co-educational school in this particular area, in this particular tribe and area of Singida. And by 1963, we had 150 graduates, and later on, how many?
Well, we had about 500 by the time I left in 76. Yeah. And we were scattered all over Tanzania.
And scattered all over Tanzania. And we think of the Christian Church in getting Christian nurses to go all over in government hospitals, all over, spreading their ways of healing. And Stan, I wish you'd say something about medical or whatever.
Well, the missions in different places sort of had different goals. Now, before I went to Africa, I read Dr. Schweitzer's work in West Africa about it, and so on. And he sort of had the idea that you couldn't train the Africans to really become the same as doctors or nurses, and so they must come from Europe. And the Africans did the menial work and were doing the work of dressers and so on, but never got any higher. And when I came out there, that was just about the state of where we were at. We just had dressers and nothing else. Now, I had come from China. I worked 5 years in China before I went there. And there I worked with a Chinese doctor, and at the Peking Union Medical Colleges, there were Chinese doctors on the staff, and they were right up there. Well, the Africans are way down there, so I sort of looked down a little bit, you know, and, well, I wonder if they ever could get to the up to where the Chinese were. And I had a change of mind or heart or something, because discovered that they were just as capable as anyone else. All they needed to have was the training. And as Margaret said, they started as their education advanced. They got to be medical assistants. Well, that's as far as we could go in Tanzania.
And so the church sent some of the best students to the States to go to college, and some of them got to go to Uganda to medical school there, McCarer Medical School in Kampala, which is comparable to a medical school in the States. I mean, perhaps not, they didn't have all the facilities, but actually they were better qualified to teach tropical medicine than our universities in this country, because they had all the diseases right on their doorsteps. And when I left now, Dr. David Jowley was my medical assistant. He worked with me, and Hosea is another one, worked with me. And at the present time, Dr. David went to medical school in Dar es Salaam. They started a school there. He is now the head of the leprosarium. And Dr. Hosea is his assistant. He went to India for 1 year of training in leprosy. David went to Edinburgh to university there, and he was just a little bit perturbed because he felt that that wouldn't work in Africa. And I told him, well, I said, I never really got any pediatrics to mount anything when I, because I just got what I had in medical school. Then I took an internship and I missed pediatrics because you could take only so many things. I said, you probably have a lot better education in that line than I ever had. And then when last year in Minneapolis, we had a little reception, and well, maybe it was a big reception. At any rate, here was one of them, another one. He was a nurse, was he not? Yeah. And now this nurse that I taught out there, he was now a doctor, and he was taking his residency in heart surgery. Well, I never got to be a surgeon. I never touched a heart any in my life. And it just makes me feel good to feel that we had a little part in sharing, bringing these people up. And I certainly had to change about as to my feelings about whether they are capable.
There's one more thought
I want to put as far as education is concerned, if I may, and that is midwifery. We had midwifery. Greta and Alice are both midwives, and they worked in this school with midwifery.
I just want to mention the older women. None of these women were able to read or write in the very first. But we had a midwife, Mama Salome. She was the one who really started, the first person whom they had confidence in, and she would get them to come to the hospital. And little by little, they listened to her, and then we had in areas about 10 places where these women would, well, just give them, as we say, teach them cleanliness to a degree, and we've gone a long ways. And therefore, I think we had about 1,000 reports. But I want to say this about the reports. They would do a so-called examination, prenatal quotes. And this one came back from a dispensary. She had a string, and on that she had about 15 knots. Then she had a piece of bandage with about 8 or 10 knots. She said, these are the exams and these are the deliveries. And the teachers at the school would write the reports for us. That's how we got the numbers.
They were way out of the bush.
And that's what...
And then I had the privilege of going, getting my midwifery in Scotland, and came back and started working with the nurses, the ones that were in nursing training and had finished nursing. and then I was able to give them the midwifery training. And I remember the old midwife that we had there, we still had one of the old granny midwives at the hospital, and she was kind of upset that these new young nurses, upstarts, you know, quote unquote, were going to take over her territory. But one of the things I told the younger nurses, midwives, I said, she may not be able to read and write, but if she tells you there's trouble, you just hightail it off and get a doctor and some help, because she knows what it is. And she used to, you know, a person would come in and we didn't remember them, and she'd say, oh, I remember her. It was during Dr. Short, the short doctor, it was Dr. Foopy, she'd say, and that was Dr. Denny Lostrom, who was very short. And it was during that doctor, and she came, and she had a terrible time, and they had to pursue her, they had to do surgery, do a section on it, you know, because it was turned wrong, and she had everything. And we did have records when we'd had them in the hospital, and I'd look it up, and I could get the date somewhat in perspective by who the doctor was, and you know, if it was rainy season or dry season, you know, and that. And I'd find that, and it would be exactly as she remembered, and she always complained, you know. So it was a real thrill. But having these nurses who, when we first started the nursing school, came in, and some of them had never seen a sheet on a bed, you know, on a mattress, and we had so good old. Then in 1974, I had the chance to go to the International Congress of Midwives in Washington, D.C., and I heard that there were some midwives from Tanzania there. And they said, yes, there were some from Kiamoy, where we had. And I thought, well, I was looking for somebody in a shuka, in a wraparound, you know, and stuff. And looked around, couldn't find, and all of a sudden they said, oh, there she is. And here was one of my nursing students and midwifery students, and she was dressed in a very smart red pantsuit, you know. She had been traveling in Europe, and then she'd come to the States and done quite a bit of traveling in the States before she came to the Congress. So it was a real thrill to see her. We had such a good time. I remember we called Margaret long distance on the phone to chat and that. But it's a real thrill to see the changes that have come about. Years that I was there, and I wasn't there that long, you know.
But, yeah. More questions. We've got medicine on the table, we've got education on the table, we've got a theme here about the growing capacity of local people in Tanzania to take up those things for themselves. Go ahead.
How about agriculture? What kind of progress? What's the situation on feeding the people there?
Who's a resident farmer here?
Well, the agriculture program was also linked together with the literacy program. And we had a missionary, Roland Brenner, who came out as an agriculturalist. And the work first among the Ilamba people, malnutrition was not as serious among them as it was among the Tutu people, because they had more fish, they had started to grow beans, and they were not only eating the stiff porridge with vegetable greens, which had been rather traditional. And in one of the first years of the literacy program, with the help and cooperation of the government agricultural department, there were, I think, 200 farmers who decided to relinquish their short or long-handled hoes and start plowing with oxen. And then they started a farmers' cooperative. This was back in the late 50s. And now, well, tractors, of course, have become very useful in Tanzania, but there isn't anyone who uses a hoe except for digging and weeding a bit. But even the elderly ladies who may not own oxen, they will rent somebody else's oxen to plow their fields. But of course now, with the villages, the people having moved into the villages, then they do have access to tractors for a lot of their cultivation. So that has
been helpful. Petrol has gone up.
The price of petrol and all of these things are, the agricultural situation, and because of the drought in Tanzania for the past 3 or 4 years, but we've had good words this year in correspondence that they have had fairly good rains, and they were expecting this year to have a really bumper crop in most of the areas where famine has been very prevalent.
Julie asked you to tell about the chagas and the coffee, didn't you? Cooperatives?
Well, the coffee company, yeah.
I lived on the slope of Kilimanjaro amongst the Chaga tribe, and they had a lot of bananas and a lot of coffee. And they, many years ago, I can't tell you what year it was, but many years ago, in the early 50s, I think, started a cooperative and did very well.
Coffee.
Selling coffee, yes. Selling coffee.
That has a rather sad sequel. Basically, when the government took over the private cooperatives, and of course some of the people that were at the top were not always honest, and people had to turn in their crops to the government cooperative and could not handle it themselves, and consequently they literally did not plant because they weren't getting the returns. It was going to the top people who were selling the coffee over on the black market, over into Kenya and over into Uganda and other places, and they saw no reason to continue. So actually, the economic situation in Tanzania right now is very serious.
We could buy coffee at the airport when we came in last year, but we couldn't buy coffee in any shop. We came to Sweden, we could buy Tanzania coffee.
Could you mention Vivian's years there?
Talk about Vivian's years. We have Lozette Jones here, who is a sister of Vivian Gulen, who spent, is it 44 years? 44 years.
40.
40 years in Tanzania. I lived with Vivian my first term when I was out there. At that time, she was principal of the Teachers Training College and Education Secretary, and she had 3 treasury books. And she was starting a Sunday school and working with the youth and just a few other things. After I had been there, just a few months, I got 2 or 3 of her sets of treasury books. And then she decided that the adult literacy program should be started, because the first Sunday I was there, I noticed people weren't able to read. So I went home and said to Bim, "They can't read." And she said, "No, they can't read." And I said, "Well, something has to be done about that." And she said, "Yes, you do it." Well, I had no intention of getting started doing any such thing, but it wasn't many weeks before she got up before the congregation at Kinabanda. And I was just learning Swahili, but I thought I understood her to say that the people who wanted to learn to read should come the next Tuesday. And so I asked her when we got home, we hadn't discussed this, and she said, "Oh yes, we're going to have literacy classes, and you're going to go up and give them health lessons." I meet from 3 to 5, and after you get through work at 5 o'clock in the office. I was working with Dr. George Anderson as his secretary at that time. And she said, "You'll go up and give them a health lesson." Well, I knew about as much about health as I did about teaching anybody to read. But anyway, that's how it all started. There were 60 women who came. And 12 of them knew a little bit about reading, so they were assigned to the teachers of the other.
There's a saying that I once heard from a third world friend: everything is worth doing, it's worth doing badly.
They learn by our mistakes. Yes, Lozette.
Well, I would like to say that since she was there for 40 years, she often said, "It's such a satisfaction to see what you started, that it's like a planting a seed. And then it grows, and then you finally reap the harvest." And she was there long enough to see that the boys that she taught to read first, and then the girls became of value, and she taught them, and then they're the ones that became the doctors, the nurses, the pastors, and all. And to her, that was the greatest satisfaction. She went home to be with the Lord the 12th of May. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. We were going to be here together. But I appreciate the privilege of being here, and she was someone that could tell everybody what they could do.
A skill that she's passed on well to a number of people here. Who else? has some questions. There was another hand over here somewhere. Yes?
Do you ever get over the feeling that Tanzania is really home to you?
I haven't. I've had the good fortune of being able to go back since I retired, about every other year to Tanzania, and I'm expecting to be back there now again in November of this year. So I haven't had to make that break, and I think, I don't know about the others.
There's never a time, I don't think, that you don't, well, Tanzania is your home. This reunion shows it. We're all very much a family. And Tanzania itself and its people, you're talking about writing and reading, you remember these people very, very much. Dear Salome, that she talked about, I'll never forget the day she came into the office and wrote her name for the first time. What a thrill to see that nobody, and here she was an old lady, older than I maybe, and she came in and she grabbed a piece of paper on my desk and a pencil and she printed out her name so proudly. You know, in church before, she always had the book upside down, you know, and so forth. But now, there was something there.
Was that Mama Salome?
Yes.
The mother of Pietro Arre?
Mother of Pietro Arre.
She had a son who was a pastor.
Yeah. Well, all of her, she had several sons that were pastors and teachers, and she was the matriarch of the tribe, without a doubt.
And another thing, she was honorably her husband. Salome was his only wife. And that was a couple that brought up a larger family. I knew only two such families. They had large families, 7, 8 children, I mean, growing up.
Well, she was got some decoration.
Yes.
King Georgie, too.
Yes, she did.
I'm from Britain.
Question from the peanut gallery.
Yeah. I'm kind of interested. I hear a lot of education went on, things like that, and the doctors maybe came to America or went to a different country. And as the people became educated, is it hard to keep the educated people in Tanzania to share with the other people and bring what they have learned into the country? Because a lot of times, the educated people leave, and that doesn't help the country.
Question of brain drain.
I would say most of them are glad to go back. I've had students we have had a number of us who've been over here and they've been educated, and we just had one that went back now in May. He got his master's degree in psychology, Vincent Lamont, and he just couldn't wait till he got back to Tanzania. I was glad for that attitude, and we had another student that went back now in May, and I'm glad when they say we just can't wait to get back, because they, like Nettie said, when people go to a country to get food and bring it back to starving people, if they eat it all themselves and don't bring it back, then they betrayed their people. Mm-hmm. And that's the way they feel about going away, getting an education, getting stuck in a good job in the States or someplace, and then they're not going back. So there may be some who stayed here, but I know many who have gone back, and they're contributing a lot to their own country.
I would agree with her, because I have several friends who did the same thing. They got their PhD, like at Stanford or something, on a very wonderful scholarship, and they could have done many things here, but they could just hardly wait. They just pestered the life out of the professors to get these tests and all these orals and everything over so they could get home. Mm-hmm. So they're just eager to get back.
Joe?
The statistics on the board amaze me. The gospel is catching there. And I wonder what, you know, we kind of pondered that. What is it? Why is it? These people that haven't heard or have their own, I imagine, their own beliefs somehow or some way. And that in the face of so much over there, like I don't know how bad in Tanzania the famine has been or whatnot. What, you know, what is your experience, your feelings about the gospel, and have you felt how powerful it is? That just amazes me. The Christianity is spreading. That's a good question. Is how? What's? Can you give any insight into your feelings,
your experience?
I'd just like
to tell one story of an old man, and this goes way back, but it tells what happened in the beginning, and it's still true. This old man, I was told, had been a great messenger of the gospel in the early days. And so I called him in and wanted to talk to him. I was still very interested in knowing what made them make the change from their old traditional religions. And he said, I was a half and half medicine man. He was earning money as a medicine man. But he said, one day a man came and stood out under the trees, and my wife and I went to listen to them, and they talked real good, but we didn't quite decide yet. And then I went off on a long trip for 3 months, and when I came back, my wife said, I've decided to be a Christian. So I went over there to listen a little more, and I went home and I took all the charms and everything I had in my half and half medicine business and buried them and burned them. So I said, now tell me, what was it that drew you? What was it that made you make the difference? Then he sang to me in the tribal language, what a friend we have in Jesus. He said, I never heard that there was a God who wanted to be my friend and who loved me. And that was one of the beginning things that attracted them.
I think this story could be multiplied hundreds of times in the hospital that we had too. Because of the African Christian nurses and dressers and people that helped in the hospitals, would witness to them. I remember old Simeon Petro's father, who was a medicine man as well. And he was never going to become a Christian. He had a son that was a Christian, but he wasn't going to. But he became ill. His sons brought him to the, had to carry him to the hospital. And because of somebody else outside of his family, gave him love and took care of him. He says, I want to be a Christian. Now his son had already been a Christian, but somebody outside the family wanted to help. And I think this, I think these stories could be told time and time again of other people. I think, I don't know if you have any stories like that, Alice, remember that?
Well, we had a Muslim man who came. He had a large ulcer on his leg, which he had had for a long time and it didn't heal. And so he came and a biopsy was done and we found it was malignant, so he had an amputation. And he stayed in the hospital for a long time. We had an African pastor who was the hospital chaplain, and he conducted worship services in each ward each day, and then he did personal witnessing to the various patients. And this man decided also to become a Christian. And when somebody asked him why, he said, because I have learned that Jesus answers prayer. He said, I've prayed many times to Muhammad, but he's never answered a prayer for me. But he said, Jesus answers prayer, and I want to follow Jesus.
I think from what I have observed in that one of the significant parts in this whole thing is the movement of the Bible school movement together with the seminary and the evangelists. And Della has worked as a teacher in the Bible school, and I think maybe that would be in line to say something there too.
And then your recent experience. I wonder how many of us attended Bible school before we went to Africa. I really don't know. Hold up your hand.
LBI.
Yeah.
Well, I taught in the Bible school for almost 13 years, and the main emphasis was strong and was just teaching Bible, because we felt that that was going to strengthen the church and make the lay Christians who probably didn't have more than the education to be able to read and write, and that was the only requirement, that anybody who came had to learn, had to know how to read and write. And it strengthened the church, it strengthened the lay Christians. Many of them did want to become evangelists and help in the church, Sunday school teachers, workers with women and so forth, but it was to help the lay people. And I agree with you, Margaret, that I believe that made a great difference in the strength of the church and the witness of the church.
I think the same thing has happened through the school system. We've had a tremendous school system, beginning with the primary school, and many would trace back their first contacts that they had with Christianity, and through the primary schools, and then on through our through our other schools, we could, you know, relate some very interesting stories about people who have come out of not only paganism, but also out of, from Mohammedanism into Christianity since, through the witness of the schools. Because they always talk.
I think the other thing that Della had experienced in her recent visit there was what's happening in the church today over there. Retelling about some of the things, Della.
Well, I visited there in 1982, and it was exciting to see how the church had changed. It had grown tremendously in a new area amongst a new tribe, and there were lots of, I think it was Pastor Olson said tonight in his study about youth, and the youth were really on the rise, and youth choirs. Well, you could have five or seven choirs in one service, and everybody vying to sing as many songs as they got a chance. The services would get to be kind of long, but it was wonderful to hear these choirs. And that was a great thing. And the youth were interested in Bible study. I was invited to speak at a high school, a secondary school. And great time of Bible study together. And here they were up in a college level almost. And that was very exciting to see. And then I talked with an older gentleman whom I had known as a carpenter, but now he was in a bigger town, and I said, I've heard that you are ministering to the church, and he was a layman, you're ministering to the church in a new way. And he said, oh yes, let me tell you about it. And it seemed as if God had given him the special gift of healing. Now this I had never seen when I had worked out there. And also casting out demons. And the pastors, ordained pastors, were calling these two men, laymen both of them, to their congregations to preach and to pray for the people and to cast out demons. And this man said to me, you know, 2 weeks ago I was at a baptismal service in one of our Lutheran congregations. A Lutheran pastor of that church baptized 105 Muslims who said, now we know where God's power is. So that was just one illustration of this gift that had come into the church and was being used by lay people in a very beautiful, meaningful way, and was bringing many people into a new relationship with Christ.
Adela, what about the release time now in the general schools? You mentioned
I briefly mentioned that. Yes, that is still something that the president of the country has done a great deal to encourage. And it's part of the school curriculum that they may have. It's just laid out that they may have two or three periods a week to teach Christianity.
And there's a service.
Or
any religion. The Muslim leaders come there too, if they want to. But I remember vividly when some years back before I went home, I was in town and they said, Mr. Mireri, the president is here today, and he's called for all the pastors in the area and all the Muslim leaders in the area to come, and he wants to meet with them. So I was very interested in talking to some of the pastors. I said, now what did Mr. Mireri, the president of the country, have to say to you today? And they said, he told us, we have set up the program so that you can teach religion those many periods a week. And I'm finding that many of you aren't using it. And I just want you to get busy and use this time. I thought that was pretty good.
This is also a few years ago, there was a question of cutting it down, and Dr. Mireri said, there is not time to teach in a short period.
every morning, radio in Tanzania, TV in Kenya, in Zambia, in Zimbabwe, begins with a devotional, and it closes every evening with a 10 to 15 minute devotional, Christian devotional, in all of these countries, and this is true in many other African countries as well. So they have greater opportunities in those countries. Christianity has been integrated into the life of the people in ways that perhaps hasn't happened.
Let's let Dan break in for a minute.
There are no pastors present, so I'm not much of a theologian, but I have to say something anyway. During the war, all the missionaries were very much worried because all the German missionaries were interned. There were a few exceptions. There were a couple who were so old that the doctor wouldn't allow them to be interned. And then there were a couple who were in charge of a mental hospital, and the government didn't have anyone to put in their place, so they were allowed to stay. But all the rest of them were interned. And we were asked to provide help for these orphan German missions. And the missionaries wanted us to take over, and they government asked us to take over, but to spread so thin, we were so few people, and I was came out. Did you say there were 13 missionaries?
Yeah,
13 missionaries. Couldn't take care of our own work. They say not all this, and then on top of that, he said, "What should we do? Because we have no pastors. We got to have pastors." And so they had a meeting at Kiomboi and decided that they should start a seminary. And so this a seminary was started at Mashame, and Dr. Royce was in charge. And they went ahead and had their first classes and so on. And from that it grew and grew and grew, and after the war it expanded. And we have a fine trained clergy in Tanzania, which had made a tremendous help. It's really marvelous. So it isn't only in the regular educational work and in medicine that they've gone forward.
Mm-hmm. We've just got time for another comment or two. Yeah. Olson, did you want to jump in?
So I just want to say how much that I have appreciated his comments this evening and throughout these days that we've been together. The church in Tanzania has had a tremendous record, and I think we are all grateful for that, for that country, and for the people of Tanzania. And I think a lot of it is the kind of people that went there to assist and to help get things started, and the people that had enough flexibility and dream and vision to work themselves out of a job, which is what happened in so many cases. And the quality of leadership of the Church of Tanzania is witness to that today. It is now the Lutheran Church there is over 1 million members, the largest Lutheran church in Africa. I would just like to throw out one quick question for closing. The church there has come a long way and has good leadership and is in a good position. The country has struggles. In your estimation, what is the real challenge for the Lutheran Church of Tanzania in the next 5-10 years?
A couple people want to take a shot at that?
That's part of my job, so I have to...
That's right. Tell Dan what to do with what he's asking.
I hope that one of the things that could happen is one of the things you mentioned yourself, Reverend Olson, that some of the people, the leaders from Tanzania, and so from not only Tanzania, but other African countries as well, could come here, perhaps just for brief times, maybe a few weeks at a time, and then return to the church, because the church in Tanzania cannot be drained of its leaders. But I think one of the things that would be very helpful if some of these leaders could come over here, because I know what difference it made in my own life in going to Tanzania. I think sometimes the Lord had to send me there to teach me what the gospel really means.
And I suppose I could have learned some of these things here at home too, but my ears weren't as open as they became when we saw how the Africans appropriated the gospel and what a difference it made. Not that there hasn't been a nominal element in Christianity in Tanzania and Kenya and many of the other African countries. Many of the kids that came to school, it was just almost automatic to be baptized because they were in a Christian school without really having encountered Jesus as Savior. But then the Holy Spirit initiated the most remarkable revival movement in the churches in Africa, beginning in Uganda and spreading down through the teachers that came from there into Tanzania and into Zambia, down into Rhodesia, into Central Africa, into Zaire, Burundi, Kenya, Uganda. It started actually in Uganda. And people who may have come into the church because it was the thing to do. It was a popular movement. Then discovered who Christ was and what he meant to them. And some of us learned also who he is and what he means to us. And I learned something about repentance. I mean, I had heard the term repentance. I had taught repentance. But experiencing repentance, that was something else. And it was through the witness of African teachers, pastors, laymen, bishops, that suddenly the Lord showed me that this I knew very little about. And there have just been tremendous changes through the way they have appropriated the Holy Spirit, as Reverend Olson mentioned. And I think we can all learn if some of these people would be allowed to come over here and share with us firsthand. We've had wonderful privileges of having this firsthand ministry to us. And it would be good if the larger church could also have the benefit of this.
Pastor Olson, I think of one instance of a missionary, I mean not of a missionary, of an African pastor who came here to the States, and he had a farewell party in the church. And he thanked the church for all their generosity, and etc. And then he posed the question, he says, okay, he says, what can we do for you? And he told me there wasn't one word said. And he says, the trouble with you American people is you think you have everything. And so therefore, there is nothing. I think that if they come over and share with us, that might help.
That's a marvelous note of humility on which to end the evening, I think. And Dan emphasizes that mission in reverse, and lacking the visitors from Tanzania themselves, you folks have brought us that message from over there this last week. Thank you for doing it. It's really a pleasure.